As some of you may know, Mennonites have not historically had a canon of saints the way more liturgical churches might, like Catholics or Lutherans or Episcopalians, but until now. It's such an honor to welcome each of these four here today. It's not just everybody who's being considered for membership in the Mennonite canon of saints. Share a little bit about yourself. St. Francis, since you're the oldest and rather odd for a denomination for a peace church, I think you're a war veteran and you ran around naked and that theft thing. But could you share a little bit about yourself?
Yes.
The hair's a little
My name is Francesco. I lived in the city of Assisi in Italy with my father. He gave me this name because he was a wealthy merchant in cloth, and he loved everything French, and so he wanted me to follow in his footsteps. And for a long time I did. As a young man, I was handsome, I was gallant, I loved fine clothing and wanted honor and glory. And I loved the life of the parties and the women. But the glory, I wanted that so much, and I could not find that there. And so I thought, what was it that made life glorious? Well, in my time, of course, what made life glorious is to become a knight, to fight in the wars. And so I was able to fight in a war, because Perugia, a neighboring city, waged the war against Assisi, and I was put in charge of several men to go and fight. Well, I learned something. I'm not very good at war. I was terrible, in fact, and we were totally defeated. It was a horrible slaughter. My men, before my eyes, were killed one by one in awful animalistic fighting. I was taken captive and put into a dungeon for nearly a year while I waited and waited. They took me captive because they knew my father was rich. And sure enough, eventually, at the end of the year, that long year in the dungeon, he paid my way to get back to Assisi. But I came back a very broken person. What I had thought was glorious, honorable, in war, it was only evil, ugly, and horrifying. I had no idea what was the route to glory, honor. I had given it up. I tried to go back in sometimes to my father's work and to the party life, but at the same time, other times I was confused and lost. I wandered around to desolate places. My friends thought I was going crazy, and they wondered if I was going to marry.
Just sounds like madness. What's the next chapter of your life? How did it unfold from there?
Well, I begged God for enlightenment, to help me understand if there was anything there. And I had a growing sense that the joys of this world were passing and worthless. One day, when I was out riding, I came across a man afflicted with leprosy, the horrible disfiguring disease that makes a person so repulsive in sight and smell that you want to run away. And I always, in my life, I had been horrified by leprosy. But for some reason, I found myself stopping the horse. I dismounted. I went to this man and took him in my arms, and I kissed his hand. A completely horrifying thought for any other time in my life. But when I did, I felt flooded with immeasurable peace. A great happiness came over me when I embraced this poor leper. And when I turned again, he was gone. I am convinced to this day that it was Jesus Christ whom I met on that road in the form of the leper. But I was still very distraught and confused. I still did not know my purpose. I spent more time out in nature and with animals, becoming an occasional hermit, and going through caves and living in the remnants of churches, old churches. One day in San Damiano, a nearby town, I was at the chapel, which was in ruins. It was completely torn down from wars, the like of which I had participated in. And Jesus appeared to me, and he called me. Francesco, he said, I want you to rebuild my ruined church. Now, at the time, I thought he meant the one where I was praying right then. And so I went. I had a plan. Aha, this is a good idea. I knew where I could get money to pay to rebuild the church. So I went and I stole a cloth from my father's shop. And I sold it. And I brought the money to the priest. And I said, here, you can buy, hire some people to rebuild this church. I thought this was my purpose. He asked where the money came from. I told him. And he said, I cannot take stolen money to rebuild the house of God. And so he gave it back to me. I threw it down on the ruins there and left. However, my father found out about this theft. This was the last straw. He was furious, and he came. He had me arrested and thrown into prison. And so there I was in prison, and then he sued. After locking me up for a time, he took me to court to get back the money. I didn't have the money, but to my surprise, the priest from the chapel de San Gimignano came, and there he was with the money. He had collected it and saved it, and he used it to buy my freedom. Still, I was completely destitute and completely bereft of my father. I could see that his way was never going to be my way, so I repudiated him in public, and I took off the fine clothing that he had provided for me. I left in rags and very poor. I had nothing to do, nothing to go to. So I went away and into another town, Gubbio, nearby town, and lived there for some time. But I never could forget San Gimignano, and I thought, I must go back there and rebuild the church, for Christ had told me to. This time I understood it was no good to do it with the hired help of someone with money that I had stolen. So I did it myself. I began the work myself. I began to take the ruined rocks and build them one on another to rebuild the walls and the arches and even the roof. And other people, other young men, saw this and puzzled over it and then came to join me. We had plenty of idle young men at this time. And so we began to work together as a band of brothers just to rebuild not only this chapel, but later on other chapels. Now it is rebuilt. And actually, if you go to Italy, about a mile away, there's also a McDonald's where you can get a Big Mac.
Now, you forgot something. You forgot to tell them about your trip to the Muslim Sultan during the Crusades.
Oh, see. Yeah, so this was when I was still very young in the faith. But I thought I needed to go because the Crusades were happening and people were killing people. The warfare I knew was not the answer. Perhaps I thought I should go and become a martyr to draw more people to the cause of Christ. So I went, thinking I would be killed. Surely, to go to the Muslims, they would kill me as soon as they saw me as a Christian. But it did not happen that way. To my surprise, I got all the way through the enemy lines. I made it safely all the way to the court of the Sultan. And he saw me, and he welcomed me. This was not what I expected, but I thought, okay, there's another way to die. I told him, I will walk through the flames to prove to you the claims of Christ are true. I imagined either I would succeed and prove the claims of Christ are true, or I would be burned up and would be a martyr that way. But that did not happen either. He refused to do this. He thought it would cause a riot. And so he said, why don't you just live with us here in peace? This was more frightening to me than dying. So I thought, no, I must go away. It has not worked here. So I left. And as I left, the Sultan, to my surprise, he gave me money to give to the Christian poor in my own country. At the same time, of course, he was slaughtering the Christians in the course of the Crusade Wars. But that is how it happened. So,
you know, Francis, I think when people think of you, They think of how you preach to the birds. They think of that image of you as a statue in the garden. It's much easier to think about that than you going past enemy lines or sleeping outside or caring for lepers. They tamed his witness. They tamed your witness.
And today, if you go on Catholic.org, for $140, you can buy a golden St. Francis medal.
Francis, it seems like you were nominated for Mennonite sainthood for being a lot of things, but one being really strange, but also having God do great things through you in the midst of that strangeness. You've had a big role in this panel so far. If you're going to say anything else to this group, I look forward to hearing about it later. And chronologically, I want to move on to Ms. Lark, who can tell her story of what's with the head covering.
Well, it's actually called a prayer covering. Women started wearing them in Germany in about the 1700s, and they took on religious significance in about the 1800s. When it became just as important as communion and baptism, as recently as the generation before me, women were only wearing them during worship and personal prayer. But by the time I came along, we wore them every day to show that we were Mennonites. Mm-hmm. It all goes back to 1 Corinthians 11:5. Men had their plain coats, but they had the option of taking theirs off. My husband always did when he had business trips in town. We wore ours all the time. I even wore mine during my job as a public school teacher. Mm-hmm. I understand that there are now many Muslim women in your town, and they also wear something on their heads. It's a bit like that.
Very much a trendsetter then, right? Way before your time and a leader, right?
Well, yes. Here is a picture of me with my young friend Fanny in 1939 and her children. I wore what she wore to show that I was just as Mennonite as she. James and I had been raised Baptist, but joined the Mennonites in about 1927. I had gotten to know Fanny with the Virginia Mennonite Conference Mission Board invited me to help out with the Vacation Bible School in 1939, singing songs and such. Some people didn't like when I would sing solos during the evening worship, thinking it was too prideful, too different from the four-part harmony. Soon, after I came to the scene in 1940, the executive committee and the mission board chose to segregate baptism, foot washing, and the holy kiss and communion. Fanny was furious. She and her husband challenged the mission board for a scriptural basis for this, only to be told that some decisions did not require scriptural backing. A few years later, she had stormed out of the church and walked home to protest the segregation of communion. She and her husband even lost their position over that. The conference felt that even though it was important to stand up, even if they lost their position over it, the conference felt that even though it was important, no matter what the consequences, it could jeopardize their peace witness if they all stood up against racism. They wanted people to resist war, but accept inequality so as not to rock the boat too much. Fanny didn't stand for that.
It's not the subjugation of women and the separation of people because of color. It's not the same as war. It treats people as chattel, nothing more, and they are made in God's image.
I just kept on wearing my prayer covering and cape dress. Even when we moved to Chicago, where the Mennonites didn't recognize that like they did in the Virginia and Pennsylvania conference. It was a quiet way to show that I belonged, a quiet protest against those who said I didn't. I was proud of my roots and who I had been born to be. I didn't see much use in the straighteners that got to be popular among African American women of my time, and I always discouraged others from doing that. But I had to put on a new identity as a Christian peacemaker, and clothing was one way to show that. I was Mennonite even though many churches refused to treat me as so. Fanny and I kept in touch. Her husband even came to help out at my husband's church, something not many white men would have done. Our church kept growing, and my sewing circle made one of the first contributions to the program, to the building campaign. While lots of people focused on protesting equality in the streets, I always preferred to work for equality in the church. I mentored many young African-American Mennonite women across the country. Even as James and I moved to St. Louis and Fresno, California, my daughter Juanita became the first black student to attend Goshen College. While white women protested the prayer covering and even stopped wearing it altogether, some of the black Mennonite women did what I never would have done with their prayer coverings, continued wearing them and turning it into a fashion accessory with ribbons or even alongside earrings. I understand that Berea Mennonite of Atlanta is now in your conference. Here is a picture of Betty Gwynn and her husband in 1970, where she was wearing a black prayer covering simply because she liked the color. Everyone has a different call in life. Fanny felt called to speaking up and storming out. I felt called to stay. Although our actions were in some ways contradictory, both of us were protesting oppression and racism. I felt like it was my call to worship with white people, challenging their racism and continue to be in relationship with them. They couldn't ignore or dismiss me and the way that they could with black people who were on the outside.
Speaking of a woman who followed her passions and lived out her faith, I want to introduce Edna Ruth Byler. Edna, could you share a bit about your life?
Sure, thank you. Well, I was born I came from Pennsylvania, from a Mennonite community. And in 1946, my husband and I traveled to Puerto Rico. And while we were there, we went to this place called La Plata Valley. And there I met these wonderful women who were very, very poor and could barely feed their children. They were disgraced. And I knew how they felt because during the Depression, my parents were in the same situation. They had no money and could barely feed us. And it was hard for them to ask for and accept help from the outside. So I kept trying to think of a way to help these women, to give them dignity. And I had this wonderful idea of selling their embroidery. You see, they made this beautiful embroidery work of cloth and blouses and table coverings. And I thought that maybe I could take them to the United States and sell them so that they could have income to feed their family.
It just strikes me the irony that I was ashamed of my father for selling cloth, and here this lady has sold the cloth as a calling from God. How often the work of God is physical. I rebuilt the church with my hands, and Rowena was sewing as she was mentoring the other ladies, and now these ladies are making things with their hands. It is physical as well as spiritual.
That's true. Well, back in Pennsylvania, Mennonite Central Committee thought my idea was a good one as well, and they even sent me to India and Jordan to find more cloth that was embroidered in this wonderful way to sell. So, for about 30 years, I sold what I found from the trunk of my Chevy. It took about that long for the project to outgrow my basement and the Mennonite Central Committee to make it an official department called Self-Help Crafts, and that was in the 1970s. In the 1980s, Self-Help Crafts became one of the founding members of the International Fair Trade Association. And that organization sets the standards for certification for fair trade practices. And then, in the 1990s, Self-Help Crafts became a retail chain called 10,000 Villages. In fact, I think your congregation started one of these, didn't they?
Indeed, yes.
Yes, I would like to go there sometime. Well, at any rate, there are now about 100 stores, and we work with 120 different artisan groups from 35 different countries. And if you want to know more about my life, there's a book written about me called From the Trunk of Grandma's Car. And I believe that you can buy it at 10,000 Villages.
Well, I'd like to also introduce Zena Barbie. And Zena, many people know of your work in the community and within this church, but What we understand is saints are both here in person and here, you know, in other ways, talking about their work, both past and present. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey?
Well, I don't have any books written about me, and I don't think those, I would call my works as great as ones I've heard here. And often I think for a person with a lot of lows in his life, that is, I don't know why I was given a name that means the highest point. I mean, I'm guilty of a lot of things. I'm judgmental. I get angry. I get depressed. I got weaknesses, just like a lot of people. But I do know in my weaknesses and the mistakes I make, I do say that I wanted to err on the side of Jesus. And so I know from anger comes forgiveness, judgment, you know, there's mercy. From hate comes love. And that's a journey. Not quite as dramatic as everyone else, but it is a journey that everyone else I know is on.
And so we have a seemingly a cast of characters here that, in your case, St. Francis, you were brought to God through your brokenness and your interesting background. Rowena, you're here because God used you to break down the walls of the church to prejudice and how people look at women. And I think you're here because God used you to empower women around the world, initially through your work in Puerto Rico. And so I think that just this panel gives us a view of a sainthood that's special, that each of us can do different things for different people. Does anyone have anything to share about how that works in your life as you look at sainthood?
Well, I'm a great copier. I imitate, read, and the best thing for me is to really follow the ones who follow Jesus. That's how I do it. That's how I stay out of trouble.
Yeah. So I want to just open it up to the congregation in terms of how you would define sainthood, both alive and dead, and what are, I think what Zena said was very interesting, that one of the beauties of looking back at prior saints is we get to copy and we get to learn and they mentor us. Does people have some ideas about sainthood or anything that was shared here that they want to comment on? Do you need to be dead to be a saint?
See, I think we're all saints. I think Christ is a great leveler, and we're all on the same level. We're all in need of Jesus, and some maybe have more inspiring lives that give us hope or folks we can copy. I want to copy Zena, but I think we're all God's people. We're all saints.
Anyone else on what they feel around this question of sainthood?
It would seem weird to me that, like, we get to define it. It seems like it would be a top-down thing rather than a us. I mean, we can guess, I think. We can choose people to model ourselves after, but sainthood, it's a big title. I don't know. It feels like it's given us a lot of power that I don't know we have.
So you'd feel more comfortable if it was defined by a hierarchy of sorts as opposed to kind of from the ground up? Sorry?
Not a human hierarchy.
Okay.
I just don't know if we could do that.
Yep.
I don't know.
It's an interesting question. Other thoughts?
When you hear the word saint, it seems too challenging.
Yeah.
And yet I'm in a worship group that gets together on Sunday afternoons, and one of the members of our group was in a horrible car accident, had a great deal of pain, and she was feeling a little uncomfortable that she wasn't able to do a lot of the outreach work that many of the rest of us were doing. So she sought something she could do. And what she ended up doing was getting a whole bunch of cards and sending them to perfect strangers. We just give her names of people who were sick or people who had lost a pet, and there was an important pet, or a name of just someone who just needed cheering up for whatever reason. And she would sit at home when she was able to do so, and not in so much pain, and sent cards. And I think the definition of sainthood can be whatever works for you. It doesn't have to be changing the world specifically.
Anyone else?
I think one of the thoughts that comes to mind when I think of sainthood is that inherent characteristic of humility. If you were to ask any saint, you know, what makes you a saint, or, you know, do you believe you're a saint, they would all deny it. And again, that inherent humility. I think for me, it's people I want to emulate, people who challenge my narrow views. And that could be alive or dead. I mean, I put my picture of my niece up there. She challenged me. I mean, she taught me a lot about myself. And I think that that's what saints do. They show our weaknesses in areas that we need to grow in.
So I think one of the things that we've sort of agreed on is that saints are role models. Some of us think that sainthood can be something that is defined by humility, but can also be kind of everyday people doing everyday things, not just people that have books written about them, but that they can do it in their own giftedness, in their own daily activities, and living out life in service of God. So I want to thank this esteemed... Oh, we have one more thought. Thank you.
Marvin, I find it very interesting, because we served in the Chicago church that the Larks founded in the 1960s. So that is very interesting. And, you know, I don't have anything profound to say about saintism, but it was interesting to hear about that.
So just thank you for to this panel for just illuminating us about sainthood, both past and present. And thank you for your contribution today. Thank you.